Please be seated. After last week, I vowed that I would find a better mask than this kind that I'm wearing today. And I did that, I thought. I figured one of those sort of turtleneck tube things that you pull up from your neck would be better. Come to find out it's probably even a little bit worse than this, so I'm just going to put up with what we got. It's good to see everyone. I was once told that it's dangerous to preach on Genesis 22, but I happen to think Genesis 22 still has a lot to say about God and about faith to us. Rabbis love to unpack this passage as it relates to us, the nature of God's relationship with Abraham, but also tells us about God's relationship with Israel and with us. God tested Abraham. This is how our reading starts. God tested Abraham. It only starts this way because the editors of the lectionary don't like to start readings with messy sentences, even though they do it sometimes. Genesis 22 really begins, "After these things, God tested Abraham." I think that's important, don't you? After these things. That's a contingency. After what things? To eliminate that little idea, "after these things," is to eliminate our context. We are human beings, and as human beings, we live out our lives in story. The story unfolds as we live. Everything that happens to us happens after these things. Our lives are journeys lived one experience at a time. We think what we think, do what we do, choose and believe the things that we do, because we each have behind us a whole storyline of these things. It is these things that give us the experience that's preparing us for the present moment. We all live after these things. Abraham is no exception. He had a long string of these things that built up to the moment of our story about the seemingly near sacrifice of Isaac. And it's only after these things that our story has the meaning it does. What are the things that lead Abraham and Isaac up to this time and place? Abraham has a unique relationship with our God, the God that created the universe. He listens to God, and God responds. God speaks, and Abraham responds. They live in dialogue. God tells him to leave his home in Ur, a city full of gods that sit on shelves and mantles without speaking or responding to anybody. And Abraham actually does it. He leaves Ur and goes on a journey in search of a promised land, which he's told will be his legacy. The legacy of God's children and a people will be established. Every step in this journey piles up more and more of these things that lead into our story. There are a couple of very important things among these things that we need to remember, I think, to help us make sense of today's account. Abraham and Sarah get impatient about how this whole promise of children does not seem to be coming to fruition, so they decide to cheat. They engage Hagar, Sarah's servant girl, to speed up the process and to try and fulfill the promise themselves. The son born of this union is Ishmael, and Abraham loves Ishmael. How could he not? But Sarah harbors jealousy issues, both with Hagar and with Ishmael, and we'd have to say that that's understandable. And one day she believes she sees Ishmael displaying some kind of attitude. The text is unclear exactly what's going on. We know that Abraham had thrown a big party. Perhaps Hagar's son Ishmael and Sarah's own son Isaac were playing together. Two brothers playing, maybe a little rough. Ishmael is older and stronger. Isaac is younger. Anyhow, Sarah doesn't like what she sees. We don't know exactly what goes on. But Sarah demands that Abraham kick Hagar and Ishmael out of the family into the wilderness of Beersheba, where they are camped. Oh, yes. We should mention that. That's right. They are camped, living in tents. No promised land yet. Abraham and his family and flocks and herds and servants and everything are nomads, dwelling as aliens in a foreign land, relying on the hospitality of people like Abimelech and his clan, about whom we read before today's part of the story begins. I'm sure you have some images of camping in your minds right now, but they're probably a bit understated compared to what we're talking about here. When we say Abraham traveled from this place to that place and camped, we're talking about an operation on par with the movement of a small army. There's Abraham and Sarah, with Hagar and Ishmael and Isaac, of course. But they were not all together in a station wagon. Both Abraham and Sarah would have had personal attendants. And because people have to eat when they're moving around, walking through the desert, walking through the wilderness, they bring a large flock of sheep with them and a herd of goats. And to carry all the stuff they have, they bring 15 or 20 camels and maybe some horses so that individuals can move more quickly away from the caravan if they need to, just like you pull a wagon or a Volkswagen behind your big camper. There might also have been some cattle or oxen, although these would have slowed things down even more. All these animals also require attendants and shepherds and food and water. On top of this, you have cookware and spices and containers of water and wine. You have a number of large tents the size of double garages, and you have dozens of large hand-woven rugs, wool rugs, to cover the ground inside those tents, probably 8 or 10 rugs per tent. You have tent poles for each of those tents that range in length from 5 feet to 10 feet long. You have miles of rope. You need a couple of spinning wheels and at least one loom for making additional fabric for repairs when they're needed, and new rugs or tents or clothing. When we talk about Abraham moving from place to place and camping, we're essentially talking about a small moving city, something for which you would need to submit an environmental impact statement today. Abraham's family and entourage built their own environment wherever they went. Hagar and Ishmael certainly had their own large tent that was visited by Abraham every day. And other servants and their families had their own tents as well. Camp is really a town. And to step outside camp is to enter the desert or the wilderness immediately. It's in this context that Sarah is harboring negative feelings about Hagar and Ishmael. Sarah demands that this boy Ishmael, son of Abraham and a slave girl, which was Sarah's idea, by the way, will not receive inheritance as the firstborn that he is. He's got to go, and his mother has to go too. This grieves Abraham deeply. But he did it. He kicked them out. After God reassures him that God will also make a great nation of Ishmael. We don't think about that. That's interesting, isn't it? These things make our story this morning more significant, both in terms of faith and of grace. Abraham has only one son left at the beginning of our story. We as Christian readers of the story today assume that we have now taken that historical fork in the road, that the story of the story that leads us to Israel and to Christ. So it seems clear to us that Isaac, son of promise, is all that makes the story important. But I'm sure it was not clear to Abraham, who had just come through these things. Isaac is all Abraham has left. He has been made to give up his older firstborn son. The Hebrew text reinforces this idea when it says, God tells Abraham to take his only son, which can also be translated his together son. In other words, the only son that is still together with Abraham, and to offer him as a burnt sacrifice. Here's where our so-called test begins. Abraham could have said, no way. He had argued with God before over the fairness of destroying Sodom and Gomorrah of all things. So why doesn't he argue with God now about this apparently senseless request from the God who had promised him an inheritance of countless children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, a nation? We don't know why Abraham doesn't argue. Maybe his anguish about Sarah's decision enters into his own. We don't know. All we know is that Abraham gets up early, saddles his donkey, cuts firewood for the sacrifice, takes Isaac and two of the family slaves, and walks for 3 days into the land of Moriah. 3 days. How many miles is that? Finally, Abraham sees the place that he is to offer Isaac. He had seen it before in a dream, maybe? Had the family caravan passed by this spot in the past, and Abraham remembered, oh, that'd be a good place to offer a sacrifice. Again, we don't know. But we now get a clue into the depth of Abraham's faith in this tense situation. Abraham says to the slaves, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there and worship, and then we will come back to you. Anything stand out about what Abraham says there? How about the phrase, then we will come back to you? We will come back. Is Abraham putting the slaves at ease? Is he putting Isaac at ease, trying to avoid suspicion about this whole situation? Or simply does he have an enormous amount of confidence in God's provision? Again, we don't know. The two of them walk on together, Abraham and Isaac, and there's that word again, together. Abraham is walking with the one that is now his only son, his together son. Their two stories are now inextricably linked. How old is Isaac? Well, we're not told, but he's old enough to take a 3-day walking journey with his father. He's old enough to carry a bunch of firewood on his back. He's old enough to figure out that there's something wrong with this picture. The fire and the wood are here, he says, but where is the lamb? Abraham answers him, God himself will provide the lamb, which can also be translated, God himself will see it. God himself will see it. In other words, God will see this situation as it really is, and God will provide in response. Abraham had learned that God sees and understands more than he does. So the two, we are told again, walk on together. This is faith at work. God had cut a covenant with Abraham earlier in which God made promises to Abraham. And in doing that, God puts himself on the line if he does not bring those promises to pass. Abraham walks in faith, knowing that not only is Isaac's life on the line, but his own life is on the line, and the sense of all the things that had gone before is on the line, and God's integrity is on the line. Isaac is Abraham's together son, and Abraham is God's together son. This is a story in which all walk together with a great deal at stake. Well, Abraham is right. God does see. Abraham, Abraham, God calls out, stopping Abraham as his hand is in motion. Here I am, Abraham responds, and he sees that God has provided a wild ram caught in a thicket for the sacrifice. We don't know how Isaac feels about all this. Perhaps he's amazed at his father's faith. Perhaps he's amazed that his father talks with some God. Perhaps he thinks his father is nuts and he's scared to death. We don't know. There are a lot of things we don't know about this story. Our story. A story in which it looks like Abraham is actually going to sacrifice his only son, his together son, because God has asked him to. But we know one very important thing. Abraham did not do it. And God responds, saying, "By your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." Don't assume that God is only talking about Abraham's apparent willingness to sacrifice Isaac when he speaks of obedience, but also about Abraham listening and responding when God tells him to stop and not do it, not go through with it. If Abraham had not obeyed that second voice of God, we would have no story. We would have no Israel. You and I would not be here this morning. Abraham and his son Isaac return together. The whole party returns together to Beersheba, and the story goes on. I wonder how Sarah would have responded if she knew about Abraham's little trip with Isaac. Does she ever find out? We don't know. This may have been a secret that Abraham and Isaac took to their deathbeds. When Jen and I were married less than 3 years, we came to believe that God wanted us to buy a specific house. We had not planned on buying a home at all. But through some close friends and the work of the Holy Spirit, God drew our attention to a house that was condemned and falling apart. And he mercifully blinded us to all the work that it would take to restore this house so that we would invest in it. Through the earnest prayers of many friends, we became confident that this house was promised to us. We did not know what to think of the faith of our friends on our behalf, at least at first, but we began to learn to walk in faith as they did. Our own faith was weak, but we were walking together with others, and God's faithfulness was great. The house was sold to another party, but it became our house. We were incapable of securing a loan to buy the house, but it became our house. We could not afford materials to repair the house, but materials showed up when we needed it. We had to tear this house apart and start over, and we were given the strength and the friends and the materials and the money to do it. We worked on this house for years, and it became a blessing to many people as it bore witness to God's provision. Anyone was welcome at this house. The house became our house because we knew it was not our house. It was God's house. Abraham's story is God's story. And God makes it our story. God takes that which is old and abused and falling apart, condemned. Abraham and Sarah had to have a sense that they had been condemned. They were close to 100 years old. And he restores it to a place of hope and blessing to others through relationship with himself. All we have to do is listen and keep walking, withholding nothing from God. Abraham lays what he treasures most about his life on that altar. The one thing he believes is the only hope for Sarah and for him to live the life that they are meant to live. The only thing, the best thing. He's not taking out the trash. He's taking his best, his most precious, his most intimate, his very identity and perceived purpose, and he's laying that on the altar. The story looks as if it might go any old direction, and tragedy is at hand. But the reality is that God has already fulfilled his promise of blessing and restoration. Our believing is not merely walking together with God, together with Abraham, together with one another into the story. There are a lot of things we don't know about the story in which we live as it unfolds. But there is one thing we do know. It will end well if we walk together with God and if we listen.